All right, and welcome to a new edition of Grok the Talk. Tonight is a special interview, a special talk with two of my favorite people, Thomas Sheridan and John Lash. Tonight we are going to be talking about the psychopaths. What are they good for, and what are we going to do about them? And we've had a lot of talks, of course, myself and John, about the psychopaths, and one with Thomas in January, I believe. So we can kind of skip into the heart of the matter as quickly as we can. First, let's go ahead and have both of you just kind of chime in here. Just do a little roll call. Thomas, can you go ahead and jump on and say hello?
Hi, Thomas. Hi, John. Good to be here.
Great. And John?
Hello to you both. Likewise. Happy to be on board.
Fantastic. So what we have here is three level-headed men who are feisty, and yet I think we all agree that the pyramids were not built by aliens, and I think that's kind of unusual to find in the alternative media these days. So I think that's a good sign that we're going to be able to jump into these matters very rationally and with some good insight. I think the first place that we want to start on this is a brief definition or what the term psychopath means, and I think it would be great to have Thomas first give us a brief outline of that.
Well, my favorite definition for the psychopath is the one that was coined by Dr. Robert Hare at the University of British Columbia in his book Without Conscience. He called them an intraspecies predator. I still think that has yet to be improved upon in terms of it actually gets to the heart of the matter. That we have amongst us a predatorial subspecies of human being that, for whatever reason, which hasn't been completely scientifically proven as to why just yet, have decided to prey upon the rest of us for whatever pathological drive that pushes them to do so. And these individuals have created a system in the West which has allowed this pathological psychopathic entity to rise up among the pyramid to the top. And they have now reached a point, we've now reached a point in history where this psychopathic individual has attained stewardship of just about all the leading branches of science, medicine, politics, corporations, social engineering, and whatever. Now, it's an interesting time because an awakening is happening. So basically, we're dealing with this interspecies predator who's more and more being found out for what they are, but is now taking steps to prevent this awakening from happening. We can go into this later on, but I will go and stick with Robert Hare's brilliant description, an interspecies predator.
John, would you like to add on to that?
Well, sure. I'd be happy to add on to that. First thing I want to say is that I'm thrilled because I used the term intra-species predator, intra, meaning within our own species, in a piece I wrote, I think at the end of 2009 on metahistory.org. There's a section on the site that comes under the general title of Open Season on Predators. And I wasn't aware at the time that anyone else was using this term. So I certainly don't need to distinguish myself. I don't care to distinguish myself as the person who introduced this term. I think that the introduction of this term into our social discourse, into academic and clinical papers, and into our general discourse is a fantastic breakthrough for our species. And I don't care who it comes from. So, you know, it came from me at that time. This is news to me. I was completely unaware that someone else writing had actually utilized that exact same term. So this is great, because what it means is that we are waking up to the presence of these characters, these players in human society, and indeed in the long-term evolution of our species as a whole. And we are confronted with the challenge not only to recognize them, to profile and recognize them, which I think Mr. Sheridan has done, but also to deal with them.
Yeah, that's interesting you said that about the interspecies predator, because things like that have happened to me too. Like, I thought I came up with the term psychopathic control grid. And to my amazement, I was looking back at a website from like 97 or something, and somebody had called it that as well. So these things happen for a reason. They enter into the collective consciousness, and we all pick up on them in our own way, and it just shows the importance of them.
Exactly. It shows that there is a breakthrough happening. There is a recognition of the profile and behavior and modus operandi of these entities, of these specimens of human of the human species, because they are human. They're human predators that prey on their own kind. And so it's really heartening to me and tremendously encouraging that the recognition of these predators is breaking through in various angles.
Yeah, it's something we have to deal with as a species. It's we can't be hiding from this anymore, because it's really brought us to the abyss. And it's just we have to be careful too, because I'm starting to notice the mainstream is trying to take back the ownership of this topic again, especially in the last, say, 6 months or so, as this has begun, as this is becoming, the psychopathic awareness is becoming mainstream. Like everything else, this stuff always breaks through from the underground, from the alternative community, in terms of actually how it's dealt with in a real way, in a common sense and rational and pragmatic way. And I do agree completely with John when he says there that we have to solve this problem. We have no choice.
So in that frame of mind of profiling them, I would like to have you both comment on what you consider the traits, like two or three, four traits that are common to what could actually be termed a psychopathic creature. I mean, how do we spot them, and how do we judge that they are not just a bad person, but someone who is, uncurable in that sense? So, Thomas, could you go ahead and do that first?
Well, Harvey Kleckley, in his book, 1940s book, The Mask of Sanity, he described the psychopath as an individual who has an internal sense of chaos and then projects this sense of internal chaos upon the rest of the world in terms of power and control over others. This almost like, you know, they create chaos, order out of their chaos, and they do this by becoming a facsimile of a regularly functioning human being. So the traits of a psychopath would be a person who has no compassion, no empathy for others, is uniquely obsessed with power and control, and this need, this drive to control and take, you know, to exploit other people is hidden behind a mask of sanity. And it's only at certain times do we get aware of this. What lies beneath the surface is a very different kind of human being altogether, a very different sort of consciousness. And there's certain insights into that, but like the most common one is they have no empathy, and there's a few others, like they have, you know, contradictory life stories often. They have high levels of the hormone testosterone. But we could sit there talking about these sort of like physiological and neurological traits forever. And what happens, it tends to muddy the water. Let's just put it down to the fact that we have people with no compassion, no empathy, and have no sort of noetic self-realization towards their own humanity and that of others. And then from that, they seek power and control over others.
And so, but it must go beyond that too as well, because just having no empathy and no compassion, they could just be kind of inert, sit-at-home types. But what we're dealing with tonight more are the ones that are causing all the havoc in the world, that have created all the problems. So what accounts for that that sort of behavior, that sort of motive, I guess you could say?
The high-functioning pathological drive of the high-functioning psychopath, the ones that we're talking concerned with today, would be driven by a need to control others out of this internal chaos that they cannot manage within themselves. Now, they do get a rush from it. They don't just do it for the money or the power or the sex or the notoriety or the attention, the narcissistic rewards. Although those things are a factor, even though they have limited emotions, they have these rushes that are very similar to what a heroin addict gets when you when they shoot up heroin. It's a sort of an instant thrill that leaves them feeling amazingly charged for a short period, but it dies off quickly. And then they seek another fix, and this next fix will be another scam or another scheme to pull off. And if they're intelligent, erudite, charming and personable on the surface, they can be extremely successful and rise to the top, especially if they come from an affluent background.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. John, would you like to add any other traits that you have specified in the psychopathic mind?
Yeah, possibly I could add something to amplify this profile. I would say, first of all, of course, I haven't talked to Thomas before, the other Thomas, and I find this profiling that he proposes really brilliant and very, very cogent and extremely helpful. And, I could only wish that we had a society, that educated us in regard to these matters, because, of course, I think we, all three of us, would agree here that one of the great problems regarding these creatures, these monstrous creatures of deceit and murderous intention and these control freaks, is that we're not educated to either perceive them or deal with them. So I really think that this profiling is vivid. Could add possibly a couple of elements from my perspective. I am working in the realm of comparative mythology and experimental mysticism. And Thomas Malone and other people are involved in what I call the Gaia Navigation Experiment. And what we are doing in this, it's a vast imaginative experiment, really. But one of the things that we are doing is trying to understand what has gone wrong with humanity, to just boil it down to the onions and the potatoes. It's really about what has gone wrong with humanity. And so we are looking, the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment are looking very closely at the nature of these predators. And we are considering very closely what drives them.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would like to do is add a suggestion from my viewpoint of what drives them. Obviously, they're driven by their power-tripping tendencies and their love of control and their love of domination and their love of conning and deceiving other people. I mean, I think this is becoming more obvious as the day goes by. Wouldn't you agree?
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. And definitely.
Yeah, right. But what I'm finding, and this is just a proposal to you both, what I'm finding is that their need to control is based on something as well. We can consider that they have a brutal need to control, and obviously they get off on it. They get a kick. They're addicted to it, which may point to a neurochemical component, which is adrenocortisone. I wonder if if that has come up in the profiling of psychopaths. But what I want to say here is that it's my dawning perception now that their need to control is fueled actually by a phobia, that they are phobic people, and that their phobia is a phobia to life itself. They have a phobia of everything that is essential to life in its natural ability to thrive and to be, to unfold in a spontaneous and beautiful manner. Now, if we look at the natural world, we see that life, the power of life in the natural environment of the mountains, the rivers, the clouds, the trees, the animals, it unfolds in a spontaneous manner, and it unfolds in a beautiful fashion. It unfolds with lavish beauty. And any human being who is still capable of beholding this lavish, beautiful, thriving activity of nature is necessarily awed by it. And comes into respect and love for it. But it's a stretch of the imagination. But I suggest that it might be a good exercise, considering psychopaths, that we consider that there are some people who do not respond to the beautiful, thriving spontaneity of nature in that manner. It frightens them. They are afraid of life itself. And, you know, I've been pondering for months now, and you would understand this, Thomas, in Japan, in regard to the satanic face of Cetus, which is the metaphor we're using in the Gaia navigation experiment, trying to look, eyeballing directly into the face of evil. I don't mean metaphysical evil. I don't mean some off-planet satanic force, because I don't believe any such thing exists. I mean social evil based in human behavior. We're looking eye to eye to this evil, and we're trying to see what is behind this evil.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really convinced now that their insane and murderous control, need for control, which is widely evident in psychopaths, is actually rooted in the fact that they have a phobia of life. A phobia of the life process itself. And this is a very difficult thing to wrap our minds around. So I'd like to ask our other participant here, I know that he's spent a great deal of time establishing the background of psychopathy and profiling it. The other side of the question is, why is it so difficult for those who are not psychopaths to perceive those who are, you know? And my guess about this, and I'll turn that over to you in a minute, but my guess about this, and this is just my guess, is that the great majority of human beings are not psychopaths. They are a small percentage of the population. And to the extent that we are not psychopaths, it is natural that human beings respond with reverence and respect and even awe to the spectacle of life. And so it is extremely difficult for us to accept or admit that there are people who do not respond in that manner. I'd really be interested in what Tom Sheridan would have to say regarding that perspective.
Yes, please. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Well, firstly, John, I'm very glad you brought that up, because it's somewhere that I'm going as well in recent times. Although my initial insight into my own research into the psychopath, I stuck with the sort of the mainstream scientific, approach to the subject. I learned about neurochemistry and neuroscience and so on. I have to admit there was a point where that ran out. It did not. I could not find the underlying reason for why psychopaths existed within a sort of a reductionist science viewpoint. Even when there's even the recent stories in Scientific America where they say it's brain damage, you have to take in mind that these tests were done upon prisoners, and many of them would have brain damage from drug abuse.
Certainly.
Like that. So that was that. Mm-hmm. It ran out for me. It ran out for me because of the now hundreds of people I have interviewed regarding the psychopathic experience. People have been in relationships with them. The language that they use to describe their feelings and sensation is metaphysical. It's not the way you speak to a doctor about a medical problem. It's more like you would speak to an exorcist about a demonic possession. And I'm not saying it's anything like this, but this is the effect it has on these people. Now, secondly, what you said there about the anti-life, the anti-natural, pathology of the psychopath. Well, that is absolutely 100% true. And this is why things like the Genome Project and the transhumanist movement is like a magnet for psychopaths, not only to be involved in the research, but also the funding. And also the general psychopath on the street seems to be almost sexually excited by these things like transhumanism and the replacement of the human condition with a technical facsimile. An organic meat robot, and this is cuts to the bone here, that what we're dealing with is a soulless being, or the way I've come to see it, as a negative predatory consciousness. Now, I first heard about you about a year ago, or a friend of mine in Colorado who knew about my work on the psychopath says, you have to hear this interview, and it was an interview with yourself, John. And you had mentioned a lot of this stuff in regarding comparative mythology into your own work, into the Gnostics and the Nag Hammadi scriptures and stuff. And the way you described it was exactly the same noetic sort of sense of realization that hit me when I first found out about what psychopaths actually were, because it answered a lot of mysteries in my life. Now, I do have an interest in this stuff myself, and if you look at true mythology, everywhere the psychopath is all over the place. In fact, it takes up a huge bulk of the canon of Western mythology, in everything from Gaelic mythology, which is full of them, to things like Germanic fairy tales from the Renaissance period. Now, what makes this especially interesting is that the motif is always the same: a pathological envy of human beings. Very common with psychopaths. Also a very common description of the fairy and the fairy folklore, and whatever you have these sort of like metaphysical non-reality grounded beings. And this was something I've been thinking about for many years after reading John Keel's book Our Haunted Planet. And I've always been at a wonder to know why we're suddenly diverted into this world of aliens and space visitors when we have thousands of years of this vast canon of human mythology telling us, no, these things live around us. And there's definitely a link between this sort of archetypal predatory consciousness and the psychopath. And I, you know, like yourself, I'm not going to say I know everything about it right now. We're all still learning. We're all still looking. But more and more now, after God knows how many years, 20 years of me researching into this stuff, the reductionist scientific viewpoint ran out. The brain chemistry scientific viewpoint ran out. And now I'm finding more and more that mythology, philosophy, and, you know, even spirituality is where the real answer to this question lies.
Well,
we're getting into the archontic aspect of this, and there's no better person to turn to for an explanation on the archons and how their influence would be felt on the human plane of things than John Lash. So, John, please take us a step further in this.
Well, you know, Thomas, it's a fact of history, and a fact of scholarship, and a fact of the history of religion that something called the mystery schools, something called the Gnostic movement, was subjected to a mass effort of obliteration. Mass effort. I don't think, honestly, myself, I mean, we've seen some massive feats of genocide on this planet, certainly, you know, the genocide of the Native American peoples of North America is a massive mm-hmm. event. But in my perspective of studies, I honestly don't know of a feat of suppression and elimination and genocidal liquidation that comes anywhere close what happened to the Gnostics and the mystery schools. And the way that I differ from other scholars who have looked at this phenomenon is very, very simple. They don't seem to ask why such an effort, such a monumental effort, ensuing over centuries, was required to wipe out the Gnostics and why they needed to be wiped out. They don't seem to ask why. And I mm-hmm. ask why. That's what makes me different from the other scholars. Because I'm of the simple common sense viewpoint that if it takes enormous effort to repress something, you want to look very closely at what is being repressed.
Mm-hmm.
Because there might be something in it that you need to know.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So
the simple desire to take over another race or another people's land or property or whatever, that's not sufficient motive to explain how vast and how long going this genocide was and still is.
Not at all. Not at all. You have to look deeper to find the ultimate motive. So what I want to say is that in my understanding, to boil it down to the most simple essence, the reason why this happened was because the Gnostics warned us about the rise of psychopathy in our own species. And the psychopaths are not stupid. I mean, let's hand it to them, you know. They are clever, and they are mm-hmm. particularly keen and vigilant regarding anything that threatens their agenda. We know that they are masters of hijacking agendas to serve their purposes. They are masters of disinformation. They are masters of distortion. And they are masters of deception. That is inherent to the psychopathic way of operating. And so the psychopaths realized that the Gnostic message, which exposed them, was a tremendous threat. And that is the reason, in my understanding, why such an enormous effort was made to wipe out the Gnostics. So the history of psychopathy can be traced closely in parallel with what happened to the Gnostics and the mystery schools. Now, to return to this, the pertinent point here is that there is a metaphysical aspect to this situation. There is. The problem of psychopathy has two sides. It has the side of human deviants, control freaks, whatever it is in human neurochemistry, whatever it is that can be profiled and diagnosed purely on human terms. But as my counterpart is pointing out here, and I'm really delighted to hear him say this, that when you go to the bottom of all the scholarship on this, it leaves something unexplained. There is mm-hmm. a metaphysical and paranormal element in the phenomenon of psychopathy, and the Gnostics pointed out exactly what it was, and they called it the presence of the Archons, or these extraterrestrial mind parasites. Now, in my view, they are not the cause of psychopathy. Psychopathy is a syndrome and a disease and a perversion that arises uniquely within our species. But the Archons are prey on that. They take advantage of that deviance, and they exaggerate it and multiply it to the point where we cannot handle it. That's mm-hmm. exactly the way that the Gnostics indicated the danger of the Archons.
Now, that's a subtle distinction that kind of needs to be stated, be stated again and concretely, is that you're not saying the Archons are the cause themselves. They're merely taking advantage of an already existent state that has occurred, and we can get into those causes, too, in a few minutes here. So it's not, that's it's right. kind of like the
that's
Flip
right,
Wilson
Thomas.
Thing,
and I can't
the,
emphasize
the devil
this
made
too
me
much.
Do it type of a thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't emphasize this too much. And sometimes I wonder if I have been cogent and precise enough in making this point.
Well, you are, but it can be kind of subtle in a sense.
It's subtle, but it's also tremendously not subtle. If I would offer a metaphor, I would put it in this way. If I am someone that wants to deceive you by my words and lie to you, and if I want to deceive you also by saying, putting on a mask and wearing a mask to make you think that I am something that I am not. So I am a psychopath, and you know, they can only survive by deception and masking. That's the only way they can survive. That's their a big part of their modus operandi. Well, mm-hmm. if I do that to you, you might be able to deal with it. But if I do that to you in an echo chamber and a hall of mirrors,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be really difficult for you to deal mm-hmm. with.
Mm-hmm.
Because the echo chamber will multiply my lies, and the hall of mirrors will multiply my masking effect.
Hmm.
And this is what the Archons do. The Gnostics were very clear, and I really hope that I have been equally very clear in pointing out that they are not the source of this problem, but they exaggerate it beyond the scale of correction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's very clear. I can see that crystal clear there. Now, Thomas, would you like to add something to that and how John's take on that? Does that kind of gel with how you see things?
Yeah, I've always, you know, the sort of like a rabid suppression of the Gnostic tradition has always set off red flags for me. Usually when something, like John said, is that suppressed, you know that there's something that they don't want to get out. Now, even when the Gnostics sort of like faded into the sort of the early version of the Illuminati in Italy and Spain, there was even attempts to co-opt and sort of dilute that, what was left of it, through things like the Bavarian Illuminati and the Grand Orient Lodge in Paris, who tried to like say that we have ownership now of this sacred knowledge, which they didn't. They were just a political force in both cases. But I find that very interesting, that if something is that suppressed, it is definitely giving you an insight into something that the control system doesn't want you to know about. Yes, the psychopath does seem to have a real neurological cause and effect to their functioning. You put their brain underneath a CAT scan or an MRI and you show them certain prompts, they're definitely deficient in the functioning of their frontal lobes and their limbic regions. I personally believe it's because they don't use them. They have no need for them. In the same way, if you're not creative, you don't fire as many synapses in the right hemisphere of your brain and so on. So it's like a horses for courses thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do believe that the underlying root of this is a predatory consciousness. That's probably within sort of mainstream thinking, the nearest way I could actually come to it. I think that the idea of the Archon from the Gnostic text ticks all the boxes there for me. There are other hints within other traditions too that are probably not a million miles away. Carlo Ginzburg, back in the 1960s, translated the interviews that were done with these Italian peasants called the Benedetti. They were also existent in the Slovak nations as well by the Inquisition in the 16th and 1700s. These people used to go into shamanic states where they would enter into an alternate reality and do battle with what they called witches. But what they described these witches as being was these sort of like pathological consciousness beings that were on the other side. And if you didn't fight them within their own domain or deal with them there, they would come into the earthly domain of these Italian peasantry within these agrarian cults and damage the communities, causing chaos and destruction to the sort of social and emotional intelligence of the community.
Hmm.
Now, the Inquisition, the Italian Inquisition, took a very deep interest in these people and spent 100 years. It just shows you, you know, why would the Italian Inquisition spend 100 years trying to deprogram a bunch of rural peasants involved in an agrarian cult in northern Italy if it wasn't for an important reason. And it was almost like I was looking at the metaphor of like maybe the Inquisition represented this negative predatory consciousness, which had manifested into our reality in the same way that Benedetti had went into their reality, the Germanic states, to fight them. So it's almost like another expression of this dualistic nature of the universe, positive and negative consciousness in this sort of battle. Now, I tend to agree with John that, yes, they don't make the psychopaths, but if you had a brain or, say, a personality that was dysfunctional and there was such a thing as a predatory consciousness, and especially considering that many of these psychopaths seem to switch on at certain specific periods in their lives, it does make sense that this predatory consciousness would take advantage of this pathological individual and societies.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt that the archontic parasites take advantage of the interspecies predators. And that, I guess, in a phrase, would sum it up for me. That's the key relationship. They are two independent sorts of entities. Gnostics described the archontic mind parasites as being literally and exactly an extraterrestrial species. They have a long story about this species. It's not just a fantasy that these people have. They have an extremely coherent and cosmological scenario explaining the existence of this species in our solar system, you know?
And it explains the solar system itself as
right.
well.
It's connected with the whole evolution of the solar system. They actually came to exist before the Earth existed, and that's why they're called archons, because it's derived from the Greek root archai, meaning before the beginning or first. So actually, as the Gnostics taught their cosmology in the frame of the Sophianic vision story, these archontic beings existed in the solar system and constructed the solar system previous to the existence of the Earth itself, and previous to the emergence of humanity. So, wow, I mean, there is a remarkable and unique cosmological perspective, if you want one. But regardless of whether or not you're going to go look at that cosmology, the Gnostics were explicit that the extraterrestrial parasites use us, those among us who are predators to our own kind. So there is a deal between those people. And what I'm perceiving lately in the course of my lifetime is that there are some human beings, we call them the psychopaths now, who are so deviated from the rest of humanity, who are so lacking in empathy, and who are so possessed with the need to control and the phobia of life that they actually become zombie vehicles for these ET parasites. This is a fact. And so there are totally archontified human beings walking around on this planet. How would we profile them in terms of the subject of our discussion here? Well, they are psychopaths who are at the extreme degree of dehumanization and of mechanically mindless violent behavior. And it's very interesting that there's a great clue about these archontified human beings contained in one of the Nag Hammadi texts, in which they say, quote, "Jerusalem is the dwelling place of many archons," end quote.
It says that.
It does indeed.
And then we have the center of the three worlds, the three Western religions, all, you know, focused upon that city.
Focused upon that city. That's right.
Yeah, and all in conflict in one way or another for the last couple of thousand years.
Tearing each other to shreds.
Almost as if, you know, the city of Jerusalem is this sort of archontic chessboard for the annihilation of the Western soul. It seems to me there's a lot of that kind of thing going on. You know, the more I look into these things, it's like, you know, they're so stripped down into humans are the fault, humans are the problem, or the human condition is the problem. Well, the vast majority of human beings are fine. You know, when 96% of us are not psychopaths. So these 4% that are here, they're here for a reason, and they have this much power for a reason. And I think it's actually an evolutionary thing in some levels. This is why this whole subject, I think, is coming to the fore now. We're being prompted at some kind of evolutionary, and when I say evolutionary, I'm not just talking about like Darwinian, but a biological evolution. I'm talking about spiritual, social, you name it, to finally deal with this issue. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to like move on as a species. It's almost like, I'm sure you guys feel the same way, there's a sense that as a species, we're stuck in a rut at the moment. We should be further advanced than we actually are. And I believe that's purely because of these predatory consciousness operating through the psychopaths.
Yeah,
that have us trapped. They have us trapped into these monotheistic religions that are battling each other.
Absolutely, there's no doubt about that, and that's why at the very outset I mentioned the pyramids, because that's proof that humans have the ability to create free energy, you know, a very long time ago, and that's where we need to go with our so-called evolution now. And apparently we have all the technology to do that. It's just being repressed, and we all know that whole story there. Now, if it's all right with the two of you, we're halfway or more into this, and I think we could go on quite a while on this thread, but I really want to go into what I would consider the main topic of this is what do we do with them? What is our actual plan of dealing with them? Where do we go from here? And obviously John has spelled these things out very well in great detail, but I want to get the two of you going on exchanging opinions on that. What do we do?
Well, my whole approach has been now for a while, and I'm sticking with this one because I think it's knowledge. If we have knowledge of the predator can't feed on us. It's as simple as that. If we're aware of what we're dealing with, and we're aware of these interspecies predators, then we know for a fact that they can't actually target us as easy as they can. So it's almost like a Pavlovian conditioning to make them stop doing what they're doing. And, you know, go back to folklore again, the emperor's new clothes. All it takes now is for enough of us to point at our leaders at the top. And it's becoming easier and easier. And pointing out that these people are psychopaths, it doesn't take an enormous stretch of convincing to point out the video of Hillary Clinton having a teenage girl giddy fit when she was told on camera about the murder of Mother Gaddafi.
Yes.
Yeah. The most blind, basic person would see that. You point, that's a psychopath, and they would go, oh, I agree with you. So they're doing us a favor as well, the psychopaths. One of the traits of psychopathology is this narcissistic cockiness. They all believe they're God inside at some level. And the more power they get, the more infallible they get. So what happens is they eventually will demolish themselves through this hubris. And this is happening more and more. And this is like things like the internet and things like YouTube, and people putting these videos up of us finally getting an insight into what these creatures are without the media filter, their media filter, you know, softening them for us and showing them as like just like us. You know, you can type, you know, you type words like Tony Blair, Hillary Clinton, Henry Kissinger, you know, George W. Bush into a search engine, and you'll see that one of the most common words to go along with them is psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a huge awakening happening now. And this is what I'll do with knowledge. Now, having said that, we have to be very careful, just like John said, that the psychopaths in charge do not try to co-opt this awakening. And I can already see early signs of it happening. There's certain individuals who are being sent out to try and pull this issue back into the mainstream, including certain academics and scientists who are almost, I'm not going to name their names, but they're almost portraying being a psychopath as almost a cuddly genetic condition. And they use terms such as the warrior gene and all this other guff that like they come out with, and the buzzwords that journalists love, and they're trying to make us believe. There was an article in the New Scientist last year one of the scientists in this research program blurted out that psychopaths are an important part and useful addition to evolution. And so this is what's happening now. We have them on the run. We have them rattled. We have to make sure that we keep our eye on the ball here and not be diverted off into, quagmires of academic psychobabble or journalistic glibness that will try and diffuse the issue. Because I think with the psychopath thing, we really have something here we can go with. It's a message that we can actually use to bring this system down, not only to like us in the alternative, but it's also, and this is why it really frightens them, it's also a message that resonates deeply within the mind of the mainstream masses as well. Because we've all met psychopaths at one stage in our life. And as soon as we're made aware of what this mystery in our life was, and it's resolved to us by learning knowledge of psychopaths, the obvious thing then is we start scaling it up to the people running the world. So that's what I've made my mission with the psychopathic thing. Just to spread the knowledge and have, programs like your own, people like myself and John and others getting out there and plugging at this message until as many people as possible on this earth have heard it and the psychopaths have nowhere to hide. That's my way I would deal with it.
John, how would you approach things?
Well, I more or less follow that commentary. I would agree in a general sense that the tide is turning against them in regard to the simple fact that we're getting onto their game. One of the areas where I find the psychopathic game is being broken, of course, is in the area of finance. We've learned so much in the last 10 years since 9/11 about the global financial mafia, and we understand that the Federal Reserve Bank is a scam, that the whole world economy is rigged by psychopaths who are running the economy through these mafia tools called central banks and so forth. This is tremendous. I think that there's been a great disclosure, massive disclosure, of the way that psychopaths operate in the last 10 years, because we had such a blow, such a psychic blow from 9/11, that it has directed some people in that direction. You know, the psychic blow of 9/11 was humongous, and it was intended to be an act of psychological warfare as much as an act of physical destruction and murder and a snuff film seen before the eyes of the world. And so basically people responded in two ways. They were either plunged into cognitive dissonance by the psyops of 9/11, which was more potent as a psyop than it was as an act of physical destruction. This is my point. Or they have been shaken into recognition of how psychopaths operate. So this is a great trend. I agree that this trend is unfolding rapidly. Where I would take a different stance is that I tend strongly toward the strategy of direct and brutal confrontation with the individuals identified as psychopaths. I don't think that they're running scared yet. I think they've still got some very, very nasty tricks up their sleeves. And there are two features about the psychopaths that concern me the most. So if I could take a minute to describe what they are, I'd like to have Thomas's response from his perspective on these two features. Sure. Okay. One of the things that I tend to do, Thomas, is to, as I'm trying to track them and track the psychopathic behavior of these interspecies predators, I often tend to think of them in comparison to serial killers. Now, you may or may not accept that analogy or parallel. I'd really like to know what you think about that. But I'll just tell you why that is such a valuable parallelism for me, because we detect in the behavior of serial killers two distinct features. And I think that these features also apply to the psychopaths, and we would be well warned to look out for these features. One of these features is that they love to play games with us. They love to play cat and mouse, and they're very, very skilled at it. So the fact that we're getting onto their game and that people are getting onto them, in certain respects, is not going to make them afraid. But it's possible that they take this as a challenge. It whets their appetite, and they like to play with us even more. You know, psychopaths are like serial killers, and they like to use codes. They like to leave a trail of breadcrumbs. They like to have their potential next victim actually coming to find them. And they are brilliant in doing that. And I would suggest that we need to be very, very wary of their skills in that respect. The second point that I would say about them, the second feature of a serial killer behavior, is that in some cases, it's known that they do want to be caught. It's a fact. You know, there one of the there are many films made about serial killers, as you know, and they're usually American films, because at any particular moment there are from 300 to 600 serial killers operating in the United States, which makes it an interesting place to live. I don't live there anymore, but if I did, I would pay attention to that statistic. So anyway, one of the movies have been made about this, as you know, and one of the most well-known movies is this movie called Seven with Brad Pitt and Kevin Spacey. Now, Kevin Spacey portrays a serial killer who uses the seven deadly sins as the theme or motif of his crimes. So he sets up and orchestrates his crimes so that they resemble the seven deadly sins. But we find out in the course of that film that he wishes to culminate his series of crimes by having himself caught and killed by the detective played by, can't remember who it is.
Morgan,
Brad Pitt,
it is.
Yeah. That he lures into his trap, okay? Well, it's true. I mean, this is an amazing movie, and this is an amazing object lesson in regarding to predators. They may want to be caught, but they're going to lure us into their trap in the process of being caught. And my suggestion is very radical and brutal. And that is, don't play games with serial killers, don't play games with psychopaths, and never assume that they're going to give up. Just go for the throat and take them out. So I'd like to know what you think of that.
Well, firstly about the serial killers, although the vast majority of psychopaths are not killers, I think inside them they are. I think the only thing that stops them from being serial killers is the social consequences. They won't be able to have fun anymore if they get caught.
Right.
But inside there, there's the Hannibal Lecter or the Pat, you know, the Patrick Bateman. They're all in there. Or, you know, they're all in there.
Right.
Now, about the cat and mouse thing, spot on. Even a lot of the work I do is with people who've been targeted and damaged by relationship psychopaths. And yes, they like to play the cat and mouse. Many of them will target people, and then when they're ready to commit to a relationship, they will just the relationship is about to begin, they will have a second doubt. This is to implement chemical changes in the target's physiology, so they become addicted upon the psychopath. And that was shown almost in a lot of these films, particularly Seven. You do see how the person hunting the psychopath becomes almost addicted to them. It's a very similar thing to almost like a Stockholm syndrome, kind of thing.
Exactly.
It's sort of like an interactive Stockholm syndrome. So it's a very interesting symbiotic dynamic there, both in the relationship and in the thing. So there, so here we are again. Let's scale this up to the social or the societal aspect of this. We have a symbiotic relationship with our leaders in terms of that, like, well, not us, but I'm talking about the general masses, in terms of that they were attracted, the masses, I'm saying, to tough leaders, to tough presidents, hard prime ministers, no-nonsense business guys, who are generally psychopathic. So that symbiotic relationship also plays out within that dynamic as well. The only thing, now, you talk about going for the jugular and going for the throat. I have mixed feelings about this. I don't have any qualms about that. If a psychopath, you know, is arrested and has been done these terrible crimes, that they, you know, they should receive whatever the maximum penalty is, that we do need to protect ourselves. Now, my first thing would always be no contact ever again, but I'm not a fool either. If I was in a complete no contact situation with a psychopath and he followed me to my house, well, I'm going to grab my machete. I'm a human being at the end of the day that has to survive within this reality and protect my family. However, we have to be careful that we don't get into a witch hunt mentality as well. And that's the one thing I'm quite cautious and quite, I won't say nervous, but apprehensive about, is this idea that the wrong people might get targeted too. So, yes, there is a revolutionary impulse within me to say, let's get these bastards once and for all. Let's rise up and take them out. It's just that I don't know how we can actually do that without becoming proto-psychopathic ourselves. You know what I'm saying? It's those kind of things that worry me.
That's a valid fear, of course. It's a valid thing to throw into the question here, is how do we avoid it becoming a repetition of what they are doing, regardless of what our desire, our goal is. How do we avoid making the same mistakes there? I can see some directions we could go in to avoid that, but I would love to hear John's take on this, because this is something that he's given extreme amount of thought to.
Well, yeah, I have, and I continue to be immersed in the contemplation of this issue. But let me say this. I mean, we could obviously continue this conversation in regard to how to handle psychopaths. It's a completely different subject from the conversation of how to identify them. Obviously, we have to identify them in the first place before we can handle them. I totally concur with Thomas's view that it would be sadly mistaken and extremely unfortunate to target the wrong people. However, if we are able to profile psychopaths accurately, then we know exactly who they are, so we know who we're going for. I would also say, the question of how we go for them is another subject. I would also say that for myself personally, I don't have any fear that I would turn into that which I am hunting. I look at it in the analogy of the hunt. And I've tried to present this on medhistory.org. I've written two essays on open season on predators. I didn't write the third essay yet, but there is a third piece that should go along with that. In those essays, I've tried very carefully to lay down the foundation in a Gaian perspective of my sense of how to deal with predators. And I regard it in this way. The human species is different from all other animals, and I consider us to be animals, on this planet, in that other animals, whether they be foxes or elephants or tigers or eagles, have a selected prey. We don't have a pre-selected range of prey. We can prey on anyone. And so it so happens that in the course of our species, I'm developing the question of facing predators here in a Gaian perspective. This is what I'm trying to do because I am convinced this is the only perspective that will satisfy the situation. Given the fact that we are evidently proven ourselves to be the one species of all animals on Earth who preys on every other species, well, that makes us exceptional. Human animals are the one species that prey on every other species. We're exceptional on that count, but we're also exceptional on a second count, that we are the only species which, in which certain members prey upon the rest of the species massively. Now, it's true that you can look at a few instances in the animal kingdom where there is same species predation, but it is an anomaly and a rarity. Whereas in our case, same species predation, interspecies predation, is highlighted dramatically. Now, as far as I'm concerned, this is what we have to look at in brutal and honest terms. If there are interspecies predators in the human species, then might not there be a call or challenge in our species to make them our prey, to make them prey? And how would we make them our prey? So this is how I'm trying to understand it. I'm developing this. I don't have the final and ultimate answer, but I'm very pleased in this three-way conversation to be able to lay out for you the perspective that I have and the direction in which I'm looking for this and with this, okay?
Thomas, how does that sound to you? How do you react to that?
Yeah. Well, John's right. We humans are not, we're not top of the food chain. The psychopaths are. And that's just an absolute fact we have to deal with. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to come on this show today, and I'm very glad I did, is because having listened to some of John's other stuff, I knew he would be the one person who would actually put this challenge up to me about dealing with it, because it's something that I've avoided to an extent myself. You know, we all try to live by this sort of like hippie drippy code of, like, you know, we all have to be peaceful and loving. But just like when I said earlier on about there's a point where the reduction of science runs out and the metaphysical comes in. Well, dealing with the psychopath on another level, there's a point where the peace, love, and no contact runs out and the proactive measures come in. It's a difficult thing for me to talk about. And just like John has said, he's still working through this. But I still think, and it's a valid dialogue. It's an important dialogue we have to have, because we are what we are. We're human beings, and this is part of the human experience to deal with these things on this level. So I'm very happy that I came today for that reason, because, you know, it's almost like I've been forced to confront this aspect of this issue as well. I think it's something that we must continue as a dialogue. But as long as we remain, you know, true to our humanity, like I said, we don't become proto-psychopathic, but we still, at the end of the day, sometimes when your back's against the wall, it takes extreme measures. One more thing I would like to say about that is, if we can identify and scientifically what they are, I believe that at the first measure towards this should be that every person running for office should be subject to a diagnostic test and an MRI scan. And if they score psychopathic, they shouldn't be allowed to hold a public position, any kind of public body or any kind of position that holds sway over the public. This would have the effect of preventing psychopaths from entering into the public domain in terms of government and things like that, because they know they'd be found out right away. It would tend to probably make them move more towards the commercial fields. And then maybe in time we could implement something like a commercial pathology law, where the CEOs of all the top corporations must be forced by law to be tested to see if they have if they score on the psychopathic scale to any high degree, which most of them would, the vast majority of them would, and that way we could keep them out. But it's going to take something like this. You see, these psychopaths have been doing things to us over the centuries, everything from genocide to propaganda to eugenics. They've been doing it all. They create this barrier between the pathology of evil in the predatory consciousness, and through all their fingers they've came at us through everything from pharmacia to GMOs to taxation to banking to financial laws, you name it, to media. It's about time we turned those things back. If we have to present our passports when we come into a country, I think the very least we can ask in return is that the leaders of those countries take a diagnostic test to see if they're a psychopath.
If I could just chime in on that point, to me that sounds like kind of the measures that would be implemented post the removal of these creatures from our planet and to keep things maintained. But then of themselves, they wouldn't be sufficient enough to stop what they're doing or to take away their power. That's just how I would react to that first time I would hear that proposal from Thomas.
That's true, but it would have to be done in incremental steps anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would also send out a message to the psychopaths that we're on to you and we're coming for you. So there's a power in that as well. Now, mm-hmm. there are, we know these things will be open to abuse as well. I can't see like these aristocratic and elite psychopaths offering themselves up for testing. And there would be the problem with fraud. And, just like we have ballot box voting fraud all over the Western world to skew the election results within so-called democratic systems,
right.
We also have to be frightened and cautious that they will do that as well. I honestly don't know the answer to how to deal with them in that level. All I know is that my attitude would be to, like, educate one person at a time, and that's one less victim for psychopaths. And one less sucker for the psychopathic control grid.
Mm. Indeed. Well, it's a huge topic, and we've just started to skim the surface of it. We have a few more minutes today, and if the two of you would like to expand any more on this, let's go there. And perhaps in the future, and in the very near future, we could continue on with this same thread. John, is there anything you would like to add in kind of in the closing minutes here?
Sure. I'm grateful for this connection you've made, Thomas, and I'd be ready, willing, and able to expand further to do a follow-up conversation, which might be required because I think this conversation has brought us just exactly to the knife's edge of this issue. I'm proposing confrontation. I am.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would be happy for the opportunity to talk more about the explicit terms in which I see confrontation. But I can give you a little hint of that right now, very briefly, in 30 seconds. You know, I lived when Kennedy was assassinated. I was in history class at the University of Maine in the afternoon, and someone came knocking on the door in the whole campus, the whole University of Maine emptied out, and we were all walking around in a state of shock because John F. Kennedy was assassinated. I was 16 years old, 17. What we may all recognize now, those of us who have looked at that event, is that it was not only the public, blatant public snuffing of a figure, but it sent a message. The assassination of Kennedy sent a message, and the message was, we're the psychopaths. We can do anything we want. We can snuff out the President of the United States in broad daylight while you're watching. And we are in control. Now, I would like to know how to send them a message. And I think that the beginning of confrontation is the first step of confrontation that we might discuss further, the three of us, if you're so inclined, is how to send them a message. Because they're always sending us messages. I think Thomas Sheridan would agree on this. They don't just do things. They love to send us messages in what they do. So what I'm proposing is there are levels of confrontation that I'm considering, but the first level is let's just open up the dialogue to this. How could we send them a message?
It's true. Yeah, it's like I even think of my own country. We had 700 years of British imperialism until Michael Collins decided that we start shooting senior government people and stop killing
British soldiers.
And within 2 years, Ireland was free.
That's right. He sent a message. It wasn't just the violence. And, you know, we have to talk about violence, of course. We don't want to become the monsters of violence that we are fighting. I totally agree with you. But violence sends a message when it is an intentional sort of violence. And they're using violence to send a message to us 24/7. So let's consider how to send a message back to them. That would, to me, be the starting point of the conversation of how to deal with predators and psychopaths. Thomas?
Well, I think let's just leave that thought on our the tips of our heads here and let them sink into your head and ponder over it, the three of us, and as well as everyone who will be listening to this. And let's pick it up from there at a future date here.
Excellent.
How does that sound to you, Thomas?
I would love it. I would love it.
Okay. And I know John has already obviously said that he's ready and willing and able to do that. So let's do that at a future date. And I thank the both of you for today. I feel a great deal of respect to both of you, obviously. And I think we've covered some good ground today. And this could proceed into some very useful and effective measures for the human race. So with that, let's go ahead and call it a day.
Excellent. Well, thank you both. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to talk with you, Thomas Sheridan.
Same here, John. I really enjoyed it. I want to thank you again for, you know, pushing my own work to the next level, because I needed this challenge, and I needed to look at this subject from a different angle, and you're certainly giving me that, and I appreciate you that. I appreciate Thomas giving me the chance to talk with John about this. It's been really fabulous, actually.
Excellent. We'll talk again then. Bye for now.
Good night.